Chapter 12, Dead American Jews, Part 3, Turning the Page. The third time there was a shooting attack against American Jews, the New York Times did not call me to ask for a quick op-ed, and neither did anyone else. I presume this was because when something happens three times, it is no longer news. Perhaps these news outlets realized just how unnewsworthy this story actually was. People murdering Jews as a 3,000-year-old global phenomenon is pretty much the opposite of news. When no one called me, I felt profoundly relieved because the things I wanted to say about it were no longer things that I could actually say. The third shooting attack and the dozen or so other physical attacks on American Jews that followed in rapid succession after it, some barely reported, were what privately changed me, perhaps because that third shooting happened at a kosher grocery store about 20 minutes from my house. Unlike after the Pittsburgh and San Diego attacks, information on the Jersey City attack was slow to accumulate. The two assailants first killed a livery driver. It was later discovered that they had Googled his Jewish-sounding surname. Then progressed to killing a police officer who had noticed their stolen U-Haul, and then proceeded to attack the grocery store, resulting in a protracted gun battle in which the grocery's owner, a customer, and a store worker were killed, along with the two assailants, who were killed by police after an exchange of fire that lasted well over an hour. The scene in the city was dramatic. Entire neighborhoods swarmed with state troopers and the National Guard, and children in nearby schools were held in lockdowns until late at night. The event was initially reported as a kind of perp chase gone horribly wrong, during which criminals outrunning cops ducked into a random store for cover. But anti-Semitic screeds found in the attacker's vehicle and in their social media postings told a different story, as did the tactical gear they wore, the massive stash of ammunition and firearms they brought along, and security camera footage showing them driving slowly down the street, checking addresses before parking and entering the market with guns blazing. Then there were the enormous quantities of explosives in their stolen truck, which the FBI agent later said had the capacity to kill people within a range of 500 yards. Their real targets, authorities surmised, were likely the 50 Jewish children in the private elementary school at the same address, directly above the store, all of whom huddled in closets for the entire gun battle, listening to their neighbors being murdered below. The delayed clarity on what exactly happened in Jersey City muted some of the public empathy that instantly followed the previous attacks. So did the identities of the attackers, both of whom were black, and their targets, who were Hasidic Jews, who, it has progressively become clear, many otherwise enlightened Americans view as absolutely fair game for bigotry. This was obvious from reporting within hours of the attack, which gave surprising emphasis to the murdered Jews as gentrifying a minority neighborhood. This was remarkable, given that the tiny Hasidic community in question, highly visible members of the world's most consistently persecuted minority, in fact came to Jersey City fleeing gentrification after being priced out of long-established Hasidic communities in Brooklyn. More tellingly, as the journalist Armin Rosen has pointed out, the apparently murderous rage against gentrification has yet to result in anyone using automatic weapons to blow away white hipsters at the newest Blue Bottle coffee franchise. What was most remarkable about this angle, however, was how it was presented in media reports as providing context. The context supplied by news outlets after this attack was breathtaking in its cruelty. As the Associated Press explained in a news report about the Jersey City murders that was picked up by NBC and many other outlets, the slayings happened in a neighborhood where Hasidic families had recently been relocating amid pushback from some local officials who complained about representatives of the community going door to door, offering to buy homes at Brooklyn prices. Like many homeowners, I too have been approached by real estate agents asking me if I wanted to sell my home. I recall saying no, though I suppose murdering these people would have also made them go away. New Jersey state newspaper, the Star-Ledger, helpfully pointed out that the attack that killed two Orthodox Jews, an Ecuadorian immigrant, and a Jersey City police detective has highlighted racial tension that had been simmering ever since ultra-Orthodox Jews began moving to a lower-income community. Even though the assailants never lived in Jersey City, and apparently chose their targets simply through internet searches for Jewish institutions in the New York area, The Washington Post began its analysis of the murders by announcing that Jersey City is grappling with whether the attack reflects underlying ethnic tensions locally and fears that it could spark new ones, Even though the rest of the article described in detail how longtime black residents and ultra-Orthodox implants alike say that they haven't experienced significant ethnic tensions here. Nonetheless, readers were informed the influx of Hasidic residents comes as many of the longtime black residents feel increasingly squeezed. This was all about gentrification, the public learned. The assailants who wore socially acceptable clothing were expressing an understandable communal sentiment. The newly dead Jews, on the other hand, were members of the unharassed majority, despite being the country's top hate crime target, according to the FBI. They were also rich, despite experiencing the same poverty rates as the rest of New York and New Jersey. On top of that, they wore unfashionable hats, so it kind of made sense that people wanted to murder their children with high-impact explosives. I was not able to find any similar context in media reports after the 2015 massacre at a black church in Charleston, South Carolina, or the 2016 massacre at an LGBTQ nightclub in Orlando, Florida, or the 2019 massacre at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas, frequented by Latino shoppers, all hate crime attacks that unambiguously targeted minority groups. In each of those cases, as was true in Jersey City, media coverage included sympathetic pieces about the victims, along with investigative pieces about the perpetrators. The latter focused on how perpetrators were drawn into violent, irrational hatred. But in reviewing media reports from the aftermath of these events, I found no coverage of how straight people in Orlando, other than the perpetrator, in other words, reasonable, non-murderous, relatable, normal neighbors, were understandably upset about gay couples setting up shop in the neighborhood and disrupting their way of life, or about how white people with deep family roots in Charleston felt understandably wistful about the black community's takeover of certain previously white neighborhoods, or about how non-Latinos in El Paso felt squeezed by ongoing tensions with Latinos who had pushed for more bilingualism in schools. No one covered this context, because doing that would be bonkers. It would be hateful victim-blaming, the equivalent of analyzing the flattering selfies of a rape victim in lurid detail in order to provide context for a sexual assault. That doesn't mean that intergroup tensions or the problems with flattering selfies aren't ever worth examining. It simply means that presenting such analysis as a hot take after a massacre is not merely disgusting and inhuman, but also a form of the very same hatred that caused the massacre. Because the sole motivation for providing such context in that moment is to inform the public that those people got what was coming to them. People who think of themselves as educated and ethical don't do this because it is both factually untrue and morally wrong. But if we're talking about Hasidic Jews, it is quite literally a different story. And there is one very simple reason why. The mental gymnastics required to get the Jersey City attack out of my head were challenging, especially when the Jewish community in the New York area was treated in the 2 weeks following this massacre to more than a dozen other assaults of varying degrees, most of them coming during the festival of Hanukkah. These included Jews being slapped, punched, kicked, and beaten on the streets by people who made their motives clear by shouting anti-Semitic insults, and many other variants on this theme that received much less attention. One that shook me personally was when a young white man broke into my student's dormitory at Yeshiva University at 4 a.m. and started a fire, using matches from the dorm lobby's Hanukkah candle lighting. All this was merely an intensified version of physical assaults on Hasidic Jews in New York that had been happening regularly for over a year. Incidents that ranged from run-of-the-mill acts of knocking elderly people to the ground to the rather more advanced tactic of clobbering someone over the head with a large paving stone, causing a fractured skull. This new normal culminated in a particularly horrifying attack when a man entered a crowded Hanukkah party at a Hasidic rabbi's house in Muncie, New York, wielding a 4-foot machete, and stabbed or slashed 5 people, all of whom were hospitalized. One victim, who fell into a coma, died several months later from his wounds. Stabbing Jews was apparently in vogue in Muncie, as this was actually the second anti-Semitic knifing in town in just over a month. The previous attack's victim was beaten and stabbed while walking to morning prayers, winding up in critical condition with head injuries. Media coverage of these attacks also sometimes featured context, read gaslighting, mentioning heated school board or zoning battles between Hasidic and non-Hasidic residents, even after the perpetrator was identified as a resident of a town 40 minutes away, One widely syndicated Associated Press article situated the previous week's bloodbath by informing millions of readers that the expansion of Hasidic communities in New York's Hudson Valley, the Catskills, and northern New Jersey has led to predictable sparring over new housing development and local political control. It has also led to flare-ups of rhetoric seen by some as anti-Semitic. In other words, the cause of bloodthirsty anti-Semitic violence is Jews living in a place. Sometimes Jews who live in places even buy land on which to live. To be fair, there were many countries and centuries in which this Jews owning land monkey business was illegal, though 21st century Hudson Valley, the Catskills, and northern New Jersey are sadly not among those enlightened locales. Predictably, this leads to sparring and flare-ups. Who wouldn't express frustration with municipal politics by hacking people with a machete? After the first attack in Pittsburgh, I was devastated. After the second attack in San Diego, I was angry. But after the third attack near my home and the season of horror that followed, I simply gave up. There was no way I could write about any of this for the New York Times or any other mainstream news outlet. I could not stomach all the to-be-sures and other verbal garbage I would have to shovel in order to express something acceptable to a non-Jewish audience in 1,000 words or less. I could no longer handle the degrading exercise of calmly explaining to the public why it was not okay to partially amputate someone's arm with a 4-foot-long blade at a holiday party, even if one had legitimate grievances with that person's town council votes. Nor could I announce, as every non-Jewish media outlet would expect, that these people whose hairstyles one dislikes are canaries in the coal mine, people whose fractured skulls we ought to care about because they serve as a warning. Because when Jews get murdered or maimed, it might be an ominous sign that actual people, people who wear athleisure, might later get attacked. I was done with this sort of thing, which amounted to politely persuading people of one's right to exist. The thought of writing about any of this for Jewish media outlets was sickening for a different reason. It was demoralizing to confront the American Jewish community's ongoing and escalating panic, the completely justified intergenerational PTSD freakout voiced constantly from every point on the political spectrum, the repetitive anxiety attacks expressed on social media, the nonstop discussion about whether this was like Berlin in 1935. This facile comparison was, of course, ridiculous on its face, as well as insulting to the overwhelming majority of Americans who responded to these attacks in exactly the opposite fashion from the mass state-sponsored violence of Nazi Germany. If anything, this felt more like Paris in 2005, a place where there was no shortage of legal protections and official goodwill, but where one wouldn't be crazy to occasionally hide a yarmulke under a baseball hat. Yet the thought of explaining this was exhausting too, and also beside the point. Was I really going to expend energy delineating why this wasn't like the Third Reich, but perhaps resembled, say, 2nd-century Egypt or 10th-century Spain? To what end? To reassure everyone that only a few Jews were actually maimed or dead, so everything was cool? Nitpicking over sloppy historical analogies was a convenient distraction. The fact was that a communal memory of multiple millennia had been activated, and it was deep and real. Of all the tedious and self-serving explanations for why this scourge was apparently re-emerging in American life, guns, Trump, trolls, Twitter, the most convincing was actually the most boring and also the most disturbing. The last few generations of American non-Jews had been chagrined by the enormity of the Holocaust, which had been perpetrated by America's enemy and which was grotesque enough to make anti-Semitism socially unacceptable, even shameful. Now that people who remembered the shock of those events were dying off, the public shame associated with expressing anti-Semitism was dying too. In other words, hating Jews was normal. And historically speaking, the decades in which my parents and I had grown up simply hadn't been normal. Now, normal was coming back. A week after that horrific Hanukkah, the Jewish community organized a No Fear, No Hate march in New York City, which 25,000 people attended, though almost no one from the particular Hasidic communities which had been attacked, whose adherents generally don't go in for that sort of thing. I didn't go in for it either, though for somewhat different reasons. It interfered with Hebrew school carpooling, for one thing, and while I knew the march was intended as an act of pride and defiance, and that those who attended found it empowering and inspiring, its mere existence felt profoundly depressing to me, almost like an admission of defeat. I watched the photos and videos pouring in from the march with a kind of uncomfortable schadenfreude. Happy that so many people had attended, and even happier that I was obligated to drive 7 children home from Hebrew school instead. But another massive Jewish gathering near my home a few days earlier had also caught my attention, one whose attendance, 90,000 people at MetLife Stadium in New Jersey's Meadowlands, dwarfed that of the march in New York. And unlike the march, it was attended by many of the people who had been directly targeted during those horrific weeks. This event, which was mirrored in parallel events around the world, was the Siyum HaShas, or conclusion of the Talmud, a ceremony celebrating the completion of communally studying the Babylonian Talmud in a program called Daf Yomi, or a page a day. Begun by a Polish rabbi in 1923 as a way to democratize Talmud study, the premise of Daf Yomi is to study one page of the Talmud each day, really two sides of one large physical page, which, with the necessary commentaries, is more like 15 pages of dense material, thereby completing the Talmud's 2,711 pages in a very reasonable 7.5 years. To those unfamiliar with Jewish text study, this probably sounds like a big commitment, but when one considers that Talmud study was traditionally a full-time affair, it was quite radical to suggest that one could actually complete the entire Talmud while still, say, holding down a job. Today, Daf Yomi, the world's largest book club, consists of hundreds of thousands of people around the world who spend those 7.5 years quite literally on the same page. When they finish, most of them start right over again. I wouldn't have fit in much at MetLife Stadium's Daf Yomi ceremony, which consisted almost entirely of men wearing black hats. Since the 5th century when the Talmud was compiled, its sources span the previous 6 centuries, women have rarely studied it. Its study was also long de-emphasized in Judaism's more liberal modern movements, including those in which I was raised. But in recent years, both of those things have been changing. This most recent Daf Yomi cycle concluded with a large-scale women's ceremony in Jerusalem, attended by thousands of women, many of whom had not only studied the text for the previous 7.5 years, but had also taught it, sometimes for large audiences in person and online. My brilliant friend, Ilana Kershan, an accomplished literary agent and translator in Jerusalem, published an award-winning memoir, If All the Seas Were Ink, describing how the daily routine of Talmud study carried her through challenging years in her own life. And her book inspired many less traditional people who had previously assumed that Talmud study wasn't for them. In the years since the last cycle began, Daf Yomi resources had also blossomed online, including a fantastic variety of podcasts, Facebook discussion groups, Instagram stories, Twitter accounts, and more, much of it geared toward people with no previous background in Talmud study. Daf Yomi was going viral. I had toyed with doing Daf Yomi at the start of the last cycle, but I had just given birth to my 4th baby, and the thought of slogging through fat volumes or clunky websites with mediocre translations was unappealing at best. But this time around, there was a game-changing free app called Safaria, Hebrew for library, which contained nearly the entire canon of traditional Jewish texts in their original Hebrew and Aramaic, along with more accessible English translations. I downloaded Safaria years earlier. It was created by an acquaintance, and I often relied on it for biblical and other references. On that frigid and depressing Sunday in January, toggling on my phone between the vast crowds of anti-hate marchers and the vast crowds of Talmud enthusiasts, I realized with utter wonder that I already had the entire Talmud in the palm of my hand. I suddenly knew what I wanted to do. Along with hundreds of thousands of people around the world, I opened to the very first page and began. Something magical happened when I switched over from looking online at news reports about anti-Semitic attacks to joining online Daf Yomi discussion groups and looking up Daf Yomi resources. The algorithms all caught on instantly, and suddenly I saw almost nothing online that wasn't related to discussions of the Talmud's opening pages, which contain a rambling, digressive, and almost bottomless conversation about when, where, and how to recite the Shema, Judaism's central statement of faith in the singularity of God. I had studied parts of the Talmud before, and in the past I'd found its structure extraordinarily annoying. The Talmud isn't written like a normal book, or even like a normal sacred text. It's not a story or a manual of religious practice or a compilation of wisdom or a book of philosophy or a commentary on the Bible or even a compendium of laws. Instead, it's more like a ridiculously long social media thread, complete with pedantic back and forths, hashtagged references, nonstop links and memes, and limitless subthreads, often with almost no discernible arc or goal. Or, to use a more timeless metaphor, it's like walking into a room full of people engaged in a heated conversation, people who are constantly interrupting one another and shunting the conversation onto different tracks, and who don't care at all if you know what they're talking about, and who therefore never bother to explain why any of this matters. For a novelist like me, who spent 20 years creating artistically designed stories engineered to draw readers in and take them to a destination, this rambling discussion passing itself off as a book, recorded incidentally in nearly indecipherable shorthand style, always struck me as exasperating in the extreme. But after the dark weeks I had just sleepwalked through and all the inexpressible anxiety that had accompanied them, I walked into this irritating conversation and experienced a strange and unexpected feeling, an undeniable sense of welcome and relief. It was like coming out of a cold, dark night into a warm and lighted room. 6 centuries of sages seemed to move over, still talking, and make space for me at the study hall table strewn with open books. I sat down, exhausted, and listened. From when the Talmud's first page begins, does one recite the evening Shema? From when the priests in the temple consume the daily sacrifices? From when the remains of those sacrifices finished burning on the altar? From dusk, which is different from sunset, up until midnight? Actually, up until dawn. How do you know when it's dawn? When you can distinguish between a white and a blue thread, the thread sewn into the corner of a garment to remind one of God's commandments, but they'll get back to that later. Really, it's up to the end of the first night watch. Or the second watch. How long is the watch, and how many are there in the night? A biblical verse suggests there are 4. Another verse suggests there are 3. During the first night watch, donkeys bray. During the second night watch, dogs bark. During the third, babies wake to nurse and wives whisper with their husbands. Maybe this is beautiful imagery, or maybe it corresponds to constellations moving across the night sky. This whole conversation is about how to tell time without clocks. Or, to put it another way, how to find one's place in the world while the world is in motion. How to hold fast to that constant point of stillness as all else changes. It's a skill, a science, an art. King David woke at midnight to praise God, according to the Psalms. How did he wake up? He had an Aeolian harp hanging above his bed, and the midnight wind would wake him. Would the wind always come at midnight, or was this wind more like a writer's inspiration, moving the poet king to rise in the dark and write his psalms of praise? It had been a number of years since I regularly recited the evening Shema. But after spending half an hour each day following complex arguments on this point, I found myself returning to it on my own and with my family, chanting the words as we drifted to sleep. There was a comfort here, a refuge as we recited the words. We were on a watch, awake in the dark. But someone was also watching us. There was also something comforting in the endlessness of the rabbi's conversations. The obsessive-compulsive thought patterns of these people felt familiar to me, a personality tic that I knew well from myself and from many of my relatives and friends, one that had always frustrated me, both in myself and in others. I'd perceived it as a fault to be corrected. But now I saw clearly what it was expressing. Grief, fear, and resilience. Until the year 70 CE, Judaism had been centered at the ancient temple in Jerusalem, where worship was mediated through priests offering sacrifices. This was a visceral physical process involving livestock and grain and wine and incense and fire and smoke. There was nothing metaphorical or intellectual about it. Even the location itself was mandated by God. After the Romans destroyed this temple and exiled the people, there was no particular reason for this religion, or even simply this people, to survive in any form. But on the eve of this temple's destruction, one sage, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, had himself smuggled out of the besieged city of Jerusalem in a coffin, after which he convinced the Roman general Vespasian to allow him to open an academy for Torah scholars in a small town far from Jerusalem. Both Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and Judaism faked their own deaths in order to survive this cataclysm. The small cadre of scholars in that small town reinvented this religion by turning it into a virtual reality system, replacing temple rituals with equally ritualized blessings and prayers, study of Torah, and elaborately regulated interpersonal ethics. The sages frantically arguing about when and how to recite which prayers are survivors and descendants of survivors, remnants of a destroyed world. They are anxious about remembering every last detail of that lost connection to God, like mourners obsessing over the tiniest memories of a beloved they have lost. One might expect that this memory would eventually fade, that people would move on. Instead, the opposite happens. Once the process of memory becomes important, the details do not fade, but rather accrue, because the memory itself becomes a living thing, enriched by every subsequent generation that brings new meaning to it. As I followed the discussions that had previously annoyed me, I realized something stunning. Many of the sages arguing with one another on each page didn't live in the same generation or even in the same century. Nor were they, for the most part, quoting written texts of what those in the previous generation or century had said. Instead, they relied on designated people who served as mental court reporters, tasked with sitting in study halls where these discussions took place and mentally recording entire conversations between sages. These records were then passed down almost entirely orally, written down only generations later. This would simply be a fascinating historical fact, except that as I turned the Talmud's pages, I discovered that it wasn't, because these people's elaborate communal memory overlapped with mine. As I followed along while the rabbis debated how prayers should be said, I frequently bumped up against actual prayers and practices, blessings of gratitude for different foods, words to recite before a journey, how and when to bow and rise, that I myself had learned when I was young, that I too knew by heart. Of course, I only knew these things because of these people on this page and all the people after them who had made the conscious decision to pass these things down to me. None of these sages needed to say what was obvious from the mere existence of this process. Destruction and humiliation didn't matter. Only memory and integrity did. Was the hour I was living through right now different from the hour they were living through then? Did it matter? From what hour does one recite the evening Shema? God prays, the sages say. There is a lot on God's mind. According to the Psalms, God is furious every day. How long does God remain angry, the sages ask? For 1/58,888th of an hour. In God's prayer, God says, "May it be my will that my compassion will overcome my anger." I wondered, was I furious every day too? I was then. Could I try to be furious only for 1/58,888th of an hour? Could my compassion overcome my anger? Was my life a mere 58,888th of an hour? From what hour does one recite the evening Shema? I was surprised by how little I was bothered by the things I didn't agree with. Perhaps you will be shocked to hear, for instance, that a 5th century text says unenlightened things about women. I could hardly have cared less. I was more surprised by how enchanted I was by what almost no one would agree with, or at least no mature adult. The Torah wasn't given to the ministering angels, one sage points out, but to people with bodies. Bodies that fart. There is an entirely unreasonable amount of material about bathrooms, farting, peeing, and pooping, which is off-putting if you are not a 12-year-old boy. Luckily, I live with a 12-year-old boy, along with a 10-year-old boy and a 7-year-old boy. And boy, were they entertained. This opened my eyes to how much of the text was perhaps intentionally funny. One extended discussion, for instance, dealt with whether one could recite the Shema while in the presence of a pile of poop. Walk at least 4 steps away from it, one sage advised. But what if you still smell it? Another asked. Well, another chimed in. Perhaps it depended whether the poop was wet or dry. But how can you determine how dry the poop is? Somebody asked, and then promptly supplied a story of how one revered teacher once sent his devoted pupil to check the specific crustiness of a piece of poop. My son's amusement at this made me realize what should have been obvious. The discussion might have been serious, especially before indoor plumbing, but there might well be a point where it crossed over to deadpan humor or bedpan humor. Either way, then as now, the world really is full of shit. We can pretend the shit is not there, or we can think through how to live with it without making ourselves sick. Similar trolling powers arose in a discussion of invisible demons that various sages claimed surrounded each person by the thousands, causing all kinds of pains and illnesses. Two major 20th century sages suggested a new translation for the ambiguous word demons, germs. Was there a way to see these demons, the sages wondered? Yes, one rabbi announced. One simply had to take the placenta of a firstborn black cat, who was herself the firstborn daughter of another firstborn black cat, grind up and burn that cat placenta, and then rub it into one's eyes, and then one will see them. Another sage followed these instructions and saw the demons, which probably looked like ground-up burnt cat placenta. I could not stop laughing. On the other hand, demons really are everywhere. They are invisible, and there are thousands of them on every screen and every pocket, spreading lies and causing pain. God is furious every day. Who isn't? The sages mourn. One rabbi, father of 10 dead sons, carries around a bone of his 10th dead son and shows it to every mourner he meets, sharing his pain and also his compassion. Another, asked to serenade a bride and groom, stands and sings, "You are going to die." Others smash glasses at weddings, a practice continued at my own. Ours is a broken world. Rebuilding is hard, daily, constant, endless. The marriage that follows the wedding, which is not a happy ending, but an imperfect beginning. From when can we recite the evening Shema? The sages obsess over how to disagree without humiliating others. One announces that it is preferable to enter a fiery furnace than to embarrass another person in public. When the president of the rabbinic high court publicly insults a sage who disagrees with him, the court impeaches him and throws him out of office. Seeing the respect given to the sage he insulted, the former president visits him at home, where he discovers the sage is a humble blacksmith. He begs forgiveness, repeating his apologies, even when the man at first ignores him. When the man accepts his apology, the court restores him to his position, though on the condition that he share the post with the sage appointed in his stead. A compromise reached with the help of the blacksmith sage on behalf of his former enemy. I studied these pages as the news blared with a presidential impeachment trial, our public life a sickening spectacle of corruption and insult with no interest in reconciliation or even integrity. There are ways to rebuild a broken world, and they require humility and empathy, a constant awareness that no one is better than anyone else. That constant awareness requires practice, vigilance, being up at all the watches. The sages know the world is broken. They hold the broken pieces tight. An old scholar who has forgotten the Torah he studied is compared to the broken pieces of the Ten Commandments, the stone tablets that Moses smashed in frustration when the people turned to idol worship. These broken tablets were put into the Ark of the Covenant along with the new tablets that replaced them. The shattered pieces also part of the contract with God. The old scholar who has forgotten what he knew is still honored, carried by the people on their journey. Sometimes I felt like that old scholar, my memory of what I once valued fading, diminished, broken. I turned the page, and these long-dead scholars carried me along. The comforting thing about Talmud study, and Daf Yomi in particular, is that you are never alone with it. Online, instead of people yelling at one another about why they were right, Daf Yomi learners gather to ask one another what the sentence means, whether their interpretation works, what the deeper meaning is. I am stunned by these strangers, by their sincerity and candor, qualities one rarely encounters today, online or off. To my amazement, many are non-Jews in the process of converting to Judaism, voluntarily joining this journey even in the darkness. To my even greater amazement, one of my fellow Daf Yomi learners is my mother, the world's least pedantic person who signed on and has shown no signs of quitting. A grandmother of 14, she also now recites the Shema because, as she says, I'm up at all the watches. A mere mother of 4, I'm up for many of them too. When we finish, we will be 7 years older in our respective generations, and also, God willing, 7 years wiser. Even if we forget what we have learned, even if we are broken, even if our forgotten wisdom rattles around inside our minds like shards of broken tablets. I still follow today's old news, but now I also turn away from it toward the old, the ancient. I am forever haunted, as all living people always are. Our minds, the dwelling places for the fears and hopes of those who came before us. I turn the page and return, carried by fellow readers living and dead, all turning the pages with me.